The Queen of Chaos. The solvent in which the prima materia as king dissolves, or the earth to which it returns, is imaginatively represented in the alchemical process by symbols characteristic of the matriarchal system. The prima materia dissolves in water, salt water, tears, or blood, as the old king dissolves in the matriarchal system, dissolves in previously confined sensuality, affect, and imagination, which threaten and transcend knowledge in its concrete form, and serve simultaneously as the matrix from which it is born. The matriarchal system is the intrapsychic representative of the queen, the great and terrible mother, who is sea, toad, fish or dragon, lioness, earth, depth, the cross, death, and matter. As Jung comments, it is the moon, the mother of all things, the vessel. It consists of opposites, has a thousand names, is an old woman and a whore. As matter alchemia, it is wisdom and teaches wisdom. It contains the elixir of life in potentia and is the mother of the savior and of the filius macrocosma. It is the earth and the serpent hidden in the earth, the blackness and the dew and the miraculous water which brings together all that is divided. The prima materia as king dissolves in the prima materia as salt water or as sea, which represent the matrix and emotion, as bitter salt water constitutes tears and tragic affect, the consequence of desire's failure. The heat, which promotes chemical solution, is the symbolic equivalent of passion, emotion, or sensuality, aspects of the intrapsychic world outside the domain of rational thought. The dissolution of the king in the matriarchal system thematically recreates the heroic/sacrificial motif of incest, creative sexual reunion with the mother. This creative reunion manifests itself first of all as psychological chaos, depression, and anxiety, and only then as recreation. The king is the son of God in previously incarnated form, who loses his effectiveness in the course of time. Ritualistic primitive regicide is predicated upon the belief that the magic power of the king, his ability to renew his subjects and the land, decreases with age. Subjection to intrapsychic and or social tyranny inevitably promotes stagnation and depression, dissolution. Nonetheless, challenge presented to the prevailing spirit of the times means the removal of knowledge from the context within which it has relevance, and the subsequent return of what is conditionally known to the domain of the terrible and promising unknown. Jung states, in order to enter into God's kingdom, the king must transform himself into the prima materia in the body of his mother, and return to the dark initial state which the alchemists called the chaos. In this massa confusa, the elements are in conflict and repel one another. All connections are dissolved. Dissolution is the prerequisite for redemption. The celebrant of the mysteries had to suffer a figurative death in order to attain transformation. The matriarchal realm, which Jung personified in imagistic representation as the anima, is the source of new knowledge, as the unknown. This makes the matriarchal realm mother/wisdom matrix of the revelation that renews. Such revelation necessarily threatens the stability of previous knowledge, however, and releases previously inhibited affect, in consequence of the dissolution of predictability and certainty. Jung states, the anima becomes creative when the king renews himself in her. Psychologically, the king stands first of all for Saul, whom we have interpreted as consciousness. But over and above that, he represents a dominant of consciousness, such as a generally accepted principle or a collective conviction or a tradition. These systems and ruling ideas age, and therefore forcibly bring about a metamorphosis of the gods. This seldom occurs as a definite collective phenomenon. Mostly, it is a change in the individual, which may, under certain conditions, affect society when the time is fulfilled. In the individual, it only means that the ruling idea is in need of renewal and alteration if it is to deal adequately with the changed outer or inner conditions. The king's original state of sickness is the certain eventual fate of concrete knowledge, posited as absolute. Since the unknown always transcends the limits of the known, no final statement about the nature of existence is possible. Attempts to limit knowledge to what is presently known must therefore necessarily result in eventual social and psychological stagnation. It is an unfortunate fact that attempts to overcome such stagnation must first result in the production of affective, motivational, and ideational chaos. Dissolution of the patriarchal in the matriarchal system, even in the voluntary pursuit of an ideal, culminates in the creation of a psychically chaotic state, symbolized in alchemy as the sickbed of the king, as the pregnancy of the queen, or as some analogical equivalent thereof. The chaotic state engendered, consequent to decision to pursue the unknown, is accompanied by emergence of various constitutive psychological factors in fantasy, embodied, personified as opposing forces, lacking mediating principle. This is precisely equivalent to an internal return to a state of polytheism, where the gods who rule humanity war without subjection to a higher order power. The alchemists described this stage of their opus as the negredo, or blackness, a condition we would associate with depression, psychological chaos, uncertainty, impulsivity, and anxiety. Blackness descends when the motivational significance of events and processes, previously held in check through adherence to a central, paradigmatically structured set of beliefs, implicit and explicit, becomes once again indeterminate and novel. The dissolution of their previously held beliefs allowed the fundamental constituent structures of the alchemist's psyche to become actively personified in fantasy. Elements of individual, patriarchal, and matriarchal systems vie in competition, lacking uniting principle, abandoned in the pursuit of the unknown. Jung states, "This initial battle is the separatio, divisio, putrefactio, mortificatio, and salutio, which all represent the original chaotic state of conflict." Dorn describes this vicious, warlike state allegorically as the four-horned serpent, which the devil, after his fall from heaven, sought to infix in the mind of man. Dorn puts the motif of war on a moral plane, and thereby approximates it to the modern concept of psychic dissociation, which, as we know, lies at the root of the psychogenic psychoses and neuroses. "In the furnace of the cross and in the fire," says the Aquarium Sapientum, quote, "man, like the earthly gold, attains to the true black raven's head. That is, he is utterly disfigured and is held in derision by the world, and this not only for 40 days and nights, or years, but often for the whole duration of his life, so much so that he experiences more heartache in his life than comfort and joy, and more sadness than pleasure. Through this spiritual death, his soul is entirely freed." End quote. Evidently, the Negredo brought about a deformation and a psychic suffering, which the author compared to the plight of the unfortunate Job. Job's unmerited misfortune, visited upon him by God, is the suffering of God's servant and a prefiguration of Christ's passion. Identification with the pre-existent cultural canon, or pretense of such identification, provides protection against the unknown and context for knowledge, but promotes tyranny. The final cost of this identification is the lie, denial of deviance and the unknown. When such identification is abandoned voluntarily or rendered impossible by circumstantial change, the affects held in check by the integrity of the previous classification system are free once again to manifest themselves. The dissolution of the king means that much of what was previously understood reverts to the unknown. This might be regarded as the reversal of the historical process that made of all gods one supreme god, or, speaking more psychologically, as the war of conflicting drives, desires, and subpersonalities that ensues when an overarching hierarchy of values has collapsed. Such a reversion places the individual in a state characterized by great uncertainty, frustration, depression, and turmoil. The Peregrination. The alchemists believed that perfection was characterized by a state of unity in which all competing opposites were united. The final stage of the alchemical procedure, the conjunction, was therefore preceded first by recognition and identification of all of the diverse aspects of the psyche warring in opposition in the belly of the Ouroboric dragon. Jung comments, "What, then, do the statements of the alchemists concerning their arcana mean, looked at psychologically? In order to answer this question, we must remember the working hypothesis we have used for the interpretation of dreams. The images in dreams and spontaneous fantasies are symbols. That is, the best possible formulation for still unknown or unconscious facts, which generally compensate the content of consciousness or the conscious attitude. If we apply this basic rule to the alchemical arcanum, we come to the conclusion that its most conspicuous quality, namely its unity and uniqueness, one is the stone, one the medicine, one the vessel, one the procedure, and one the disposition, presupposes a dissociated consciousness. For no one who is one himself needs oneness as a medicine. Nor, we might add, does anyone who is unconscious of his dissociation. For a conscious situation of distress is needed in order to activate the archetype of unity. From this, we may conclude that the more philosophically minded alchemists were people who did not feel satisfied with the then prevailing view of the world, that is, with the Christian faith, although they were convinced of its truth. In this latter respect, we find in the classical Latin and Greek literature of alchemy no evidences to the contrary, but rather, so far as Christian treatises are concerned, abundant testimony to the firmness of their Christian convictions. Since Christianity is expressly a system of salvation, founded, moreover, on God's plan of redemption, and God is unity par excellence, one must ask oneself why the alchemists still felt a disunity in themselves, or not at one with themselves, when their faith, so it would appear, gave them every opportunity for unity and unison. This question has lost nothing of its topicality today. On the contrary, this global recognition was conceptualized variously as a journey to the four corners of the earth, the peregrination, or as familiarization with every aspect of being, as a vast expansion of self-knowledge. The incorporation of all competing states of motivation into a single hierarchy of value presupposes recognition of all diverse, painful, uncomfortable, difficult-to-manage desires and the forging of an agreement between them. This can be most accurately viewed as a potentially redemptive expansion of self-consciousness. It might be said, emergence of the limited self-consciousness symbolically represented in myths of the fall constituted grounds for the descent of man. The alchemical philosophers, meditating endlessly on the nature of perfection or the transformative processes necessary for the production of perfection, came to realize that increased self-consciousness might constitute recompense for expulsion from paradise. But identification of all competing desires meant clear-headed recognition of the truly tragic situation of man and of all the sinful and mortal weaknesses, sins, and insufficiencies associated with individual being, and then the attempt to come to real terms with that situation and those limitations. If you are a miserable and disorganized fool, producing chaos wherever you go, it is tremendously painful to recognize yourself and to see the enormity of the job ahead of you. It is very difficult to replace delusional identification with the persona with clear-headed apprehension of the real and insufficient individual personality. This clearer vision or conception is something attained at no small cost, and this says nothing about the cost of transforming that conception into action. The savage wild animal, as Jung has it, the hungry robber, the wolf, lion, and other ravening beasts, served as apt representative of the unredeemed individual from the alchemical perspective. Emergence and recognition of this animal is necessary precondition to his transformation. This idea is represented imagistically in Figure 64, the wolf as prima materia, devouring the dead king. This devouring of the dead king by the now recognized beast of the underworld is very much akin to Solzhenitsyn's discovery of his personal responsibility for the gulag that imprisoned him. For a typical modern, an equal shock might be produced by his discovery of identity with the Nazi. The barbarians of Hitler's state were normal men. Normal men, like you and me. This cannot be emphasized strongly enough. But the normal man does not conceptualize himself as Nazi. This means merely that his self-concept provides him with illusory security, as a prison protects its inmates from the outside. But the Nazi actions, that is, the willful torture of innocence and enjoyment of such, is well within the normal man's range of capacities and does not likely exhaust them. The individual is a terrible force for evil. Recognition of that force, real recognition, the kind that comes as a staggering blow, is a precondition for any profound improvement in character. By such improvement, I mean the capacity to bear the tragedy of existence, to transcend that tragedy, and not to degenerate instead into something unconsciously desirous of disseminating pain and misery. Jung states, "It is worth noting that the animal is the symbolic carrier of the self, the psychic totality. This hint in the alchemist Meyer is borne out by modern individuals who have no notion of alchemy. It expresses the fact that the structure of wholeness was always present but was buried in profound unconsciousness, where it can always be found again if one is willing to risk one's skin to attain the greatest possible range of consciousness through the greatest possible self-knowledge, a harsh and bitter drink usually reserved for hell. The throne of God seems to be no unworthy reward for such trials." For self-knowledge, in the total meaning of the word, is not a one-sided intellectual pastime, but a journey through the four continents where one is exposed to all the dangers of land, sea, air, and fire. Any total act of recognition worthy of the name embraces the four, or 360, aspects of existence. Nothing may be disregarded. When Ignatius Loyalis recommended imagination through the five senses to the meditant and told him to imitate Christ by use of his senses, what he had in mind was the fullest possible realization of the object of contemplation. Quite apart from the moral or other effects of this kind of meditation, its chief effect is the training of consciousness, of the capacity for concentration, and of attention and clarity of thought. The corresponding forms of yoga have similar effects. But in contrast to these traditional modes of realization, where the meditant projects himself into some prescribed form, the self-knowledge alluded to by Meyer is a projection into the empirical self as it actually is. It is not the self we like to imagine ourselves to be after carefully removing all the blemishes, but the empirical ego just as it is, with everything that it does and everything that happens to it. Everybody would like to be quit of this odious adjunct, which is precisely why in the East the ego is explained as illusion and why in the West it is offered up in sacrifice to the Christ figure. By contrast, the aim of the mystical peregrination is to understand all parts of the world, to achieve the greatest possible extension of consciousness, as though its guiding principle were the Carpocratic idea that one is delivered from no sin which one has not committed, not a turning away from its empirical so-ness, but the fullest possible experience of the ego as reflected in the 10,000 things. That is the goal of the peregrination. The mask each person wears in society is based upon the pretense that the individual is identical with his culture, usually with the best elements of that culture. The fool, hiding behind the mask, is composed of individual deviance, which is deceitfully avoided, lied about, out of fear. This deviant, unlived life contains the worst and the best tendencies of the individual, suppressed by cultural opinion because they threaten the norm. Forced underground by the individual himself because they threaten personal short-term psychological stability, which means group identification and ongoing inhibition of fear. In the absence of an integrated hierarchical moral patriarchal system, competing values and viewpoints tend toward disintegration as each pursues its own end, as greed might make the pursuit of lust difficult, as hunger might render love impossible. When a moral system undergoes dissolution and loses its absolute validity, its higher moral structure, the values which it held in union revert to incompatibility, at least from the conscious viewpoint. This war of conflicting values, of which each is in itself a necessary divine force, engenders confusion, disorientation, and despair. Such despair, which can be truly unbearable, might be considered the first pitfall of moral transformation. Mere contemplation of the possibility of such a state usually engenders sufficient discomfort to bring further moral development to a halt. The alchemist, however, implicitly adopted a heroic role when he voluntarily determined to pursue the unknown in search of the ideal. His unconscious identification with this eternal image, his active incarnation of the mythological role, enabled him to persevere in his quest in the face of grave difficulty. Jung states, "Only the living presence of the eternal images can lend the human psyche a dignity which makes it morally possible for a man to stand by his own soul and be convinced that it is worth his while to persevere with it. Only then will he realize that the conflict is in him, that the discord and tribulation are his riches, which should not be squandered by attacking others, and that, if fate should exact a debt from him in the form of guilt, it is a debt to himself. Then he will recognize the worth of his psyche, for nobody can owe a debt to a mere nothing. But when he loses his own values, he becomes a hungry robber, the wolf, lion, and other ravening beasts, which for the alchemist symbolize the appetites that break loose when the black waters of chaos, i.e., the unconsciousness of projection, have swallowed up the king. The unknown is contaminated with the psychoanalytic unconscious, so to speak, because everything we do not know about ourselves, and everything we have experienced and assimilated but not accommodated to, has the same affective status as everything that exists merely as potential. All thoughts and impulses we avoid or suppress because they threaten our self-conception or notion of the world, and all fantasies we experience but do not admit to, exist in the same domain as chaos, the mother of all things, and serve to undermine our faith in our most vital presumptions. The encounter with the unknown, therefore, is simultaneously encounter with those aspects of ourselves heretofore defined as other, despite their indisputable existence. This integration means making behavioral potentialities previously disregarded available for conscious use, means reconstruction of a self-model that accurately represents such potential. Experiences which are currently deemed taboo, forbidden from the perspective of the currently extant moral schema, may therefore contain within them seeds of creative solution to problems that remain unsolved or may arise in the future. Taboo experience may yet constitute unmined and redemptive possibility. Tales of the traveling sage, wandering magician, or courageous adventurer constitute recognition of the utility of such potential. From the perspective of such narratives, a totality of experience and action is the necessary precondition for the attainment of wisdom. This total immersion in life is the mystical peregrination of the medieval alchemist in search of the philosopher's stone, or the journey of Buddha through the complete sensory, erotic, and philosophical realms prior to his attainment of enlightenment. The ritual of pilgrimage, the journey to the holy city, constitutes half ritual, half dramatic enactment of this idea. The pilgrim voluntarily places him or herself outside the protective walls of original culture, and through the difficult and demanding actual journey to unknown but holy lands, catalyzes a psychological process of broadening, integration, and maturation. It is in this manner that a true quest inevitably fulfills itself, even though its final impossible goal, the Holy Grail, for example, may remain concretely unattained. The necessity for experience as the precondition for wisdom may appear self-evident once due consideration has been applied to the problem, since wisdom is obviously derived from experience. But the crux of the matter is that those elements of experience that foster denial or avoidance, and therefore remain unencountered or unprocessed, always border on the maddening. This is particularly true from the psychological rather than ritual perspective. The holy pilgrimage, in its abstract or spiritual version, is the journey through elements of experience and personal character that constitute the subjective world of experience, rather than the shared social and natural world. The inner world is divided into familiar and unknown territory, much as the outer. The psychological purpose of the rite of passage adventure, and the reason for the popularity of such journeys in actuality and in drama, is the development of character in consequence of confrontation with the unknown. A journey to the place that is most feared, however, can be undertaken spiritually much as concretely. What spiritually means, however, in such a context, is a peregrination through the rejected, hated, and violently suppressed aspects of personal experience. This is most literally a voyage to the land of the enemy, to the heart of darkness. When experience calls the absolute validity of a given belief system into question, the validity of the definitions of immorality and of enmity contained within that system also become questionable. As Nietzsche points out, "For one may doubt, first, whether there are any opposites at all, and secondly, whether these popular valuations and opposite values on which the metaphysicians put their seal are not perhaps merely foreground estimates, only provisional perspectives, perhaps even from some nook, perhaps from below, frog perspectives, as it were, to borrow an expression painters use. For all the value that the true, the truthful, the selfless may deserve, it would still be possible that a higher and more fundamental value for life might have to be ascribed to deception, selfishness, and lust. It might even be possible that what constitutes the value of these good and revered things is precisely that they are insidiously related, tied to, and involved with these wicked, seemingly opposite things, maybe even one with them in essence. Recognition of potential in the transformation of the prima materia meant re-encounter with personal experience formerly suppressed by cultural pressure and personal decision. Such experience might have included hatred, cruelty, physical passion, greed, cowardice, confusion, doubt, flight of imagination, freedom of thought, and personal talent. Things we avoid or deny are precisely those things that transcend our individual competence as presently construed. The things or situations that define our limitations and that represent inferiority, failure, decomposition, weakness, and death. This means that everything despised and feared, every object of hatred and contempt, everything signifying cowardice, ruthlessness, ignorance, every experience that cries out for denial may yet constitute information necessary for life. Jung states, "In general, the alchemists strove for a total union of opposites in symbolic form, and this they regarded as the indispensable condition for the healing of all ills. Hence, they sought to find ways and means to produce that substance in which all opposites were united." Alchemy speaks of the union of soul sparks to produce the gold. These sparks, scintillae, are the light in the darkness, the consciousness associated with poorly integrated or even hostile elements of individual personality. The germ or seed of unity may manifest itself symbolically at any time in the procedure and comes to dominate later if procedure is successful. This center, Jung's self, unites the disparate elements, the compulsion of the stars, into one in the course of a circular cyclical journey, in the course of the revolutionary spiral path of the way. This emergent center was regarded by the alchemists as the spirit Mercurius, the trickster who was embedded in matter, or as the mythical pelican who fed her offspring with her own body and blood and was therefore an allegory both of Christ and the self-nourishing Ouroboros. The center was also regarded as the philosophical stone, the solitaire, rejected by the builders, directly identified with Christ, and as the rock upon which security itself might be founded. This stone, this immovable and indestructible center, incorporated the patriarchal and matriarchal principles, the king and the queen, and was also regarded as the offspring of chaos, fertilized by order. The emergence of the lapis-slash-Christ-slash-pelican from the domain of the Dragon of Chaos is represented in Figure 65, Dragon of Chaos, as birthplace of Christ and the lapis. The mythological hero faces the unknown voluntarily, cuts it up, and makes the world out of its pieces, identifies and overcomes evil, and rescues the ancestral father languishing in the underworld, unites consciously with the Virgin Mother and produces the divine child, and mediates between opposing and warlike kings. He is, therefore, explorer, creator, lover, judge, and peacemaker. The hero is also he who has traveled everywhere, he who has mastered strange territory, even that inhabited by his enemy. This traveling everywhere and mastering of strange territory has a psychological significance and a social meaning. The divine hero knows and understands the ways of the enemy and can use them to advantage. The conjunction. The process of complete recognition, symbolized or dramatized as the peregrination, sets the stage for activation of the final alchemical sequence, which consisted of the hypothetical union of all now manifest things. Jung outlines the Eraclius vision in his text Psychology and Alchemy. This vision contains all the elements of the alchemical theory portrayed in episodic/narrative form. Its sequential analysis helps shed dramatic light on the nature of the conjunction. Jung begins. Eraclius, a Byzantine alchemist of the 8th or 9th century, tells of his adventures with the Rex Marinus, in whose kingdom nothing prospers and nothing is begotten. Moreover, there are no philosophers there. Only like mates with like. Consequently, there is no procreation. The king must seek the counsel of the philosophers and mate Thebridius with Bea, his two children, whom he has hatched in his brain. Jung comments, Thebridius is the masculine spiritual principle of light and logos, which, like the Gnostic nous, sinks into the embrace of physical nature. This is an elaboration of an idea Jung presented earlier. Nous seems to be identical with the god Anthropos. He appears alongside the demiurge and is the adversary of the planetary spheres. He rends the circle of the spheres and leans down to earth and water, i.e., is about to project himself into the elements. His shadow falls upon the earth, but his image is reflected in the water. This kindles the love of the elements. And he himself is so charmed with the reflected image of divine beauty that he would fain take up his abode within it. But scarcely has he set foot upon the earth when Physis locks him in a passionate embrace. It is important to understand this commentary as well to completely appreciate the nature of the prima materia. The prima materia, Physis, contains spirit, the masculine principle, as well as matter, the feminine, Bea, in this narrative. The prima materia, dragon of chaos, serves simultaneously as the source of things, the subject to whom things appear, and the representation of the things characteristic of that subject. This is not a mere material source. It is the absolute unknown itself, in whose embrace spirit sleeps until it is released, in the course of the exploration that transforms the self as well as producing something real and new. Jung continues with an idea that we are now familiar with. When we are told that the king is inanimate or that his land is unfruitful, it is equivalent to saying that the hidden state is one of latency and potentiality. The darkness and depths of the sea, which stand for the unknown, symbolize the unconscious state of an invisible content that is projected. Inasmuch as such a content belongs to the total personality and is only apparently severed from its context by projection, there is always an attraction between conscious mind and projected content. Generally, it takes the form of a fascination. This, in the alchemical allegory, is expressed by the king's cry for help from the depths of his unconscious, dissociated state. The conscious mind should respond to this call. One should render service to the king, for this would be not only wisdom, but salvation as well. Yet this brings with it the necessity of a descent into the dark world of the unconscious, the unknown. The perilous adventure of the night sea journey, whose end and aim is the restoration of life, resurrection, and the triumph over death. Despite the risk, Eraclius and his imaginary companions brave the quest into the kingdom of the submerged king. This quest ends terribly with the death of Thebridius. His death echoes that of Osiris and symbolizes the completion of the spirit's descent into matter, or the unconscious, or the unknown, where it then lies implicit or unrevealed and calls for rescue, offering riches to its redeemer. Jung continues with the story. The death of the king's son is naturally a delicate and dangerous matter. By descending into the unconscious, the conscious mind puts itself in a perilous position, for it is apparently extinguishing itself. It is in the situation of the primitive hero who is devoured by the dragon. The deliberate and indeed wanton provocation of this state is a sacrilege or breach of taboo attended by the severest punishments. Accordingly, the king imprisons Eraclius and his companions in a triple glass house together with the corpse of the king's son. The heroes are held captive in the underworld at the bottom of the sea, where, exposed to every kind of terror, they languish for 80 days in an intense heat. At the request of Eraclius, Bea is imprisoned with them. The Rosarium vision of the Visio interprets the prison as Bea's womb. Clearly, they have been overpowered by the unconscious, the unknown, and are helplessly abandoned, which means that they have volunteered to die in order to beget a new and fruitful life in that region of the psyche which has hitherto lain fallow in darkest unconsciousness and under the shadow of death. The purpose of the story, in describing this descent, is demonstration that only in the region of danger, watery abyss, cavern, forest, island, castle, etc., can one find the treasure hard to attain. Jewel, virgin, life potion, victory over death. Jung ends his commentary. The dread and resistance which every natural human being experiences when it comes to delving too deeply into himself is, at bottom, the fear of the journey to Hades. If it were only resistance that he felt, it would not be so bad. In actual fact, however, the psychic substratum, that dark realm of the unknown, exercises a fascinating attraction that threatens to become the more overpowering the further he penetrates into it. The psychological danger that arises here is the disintegration of personality into its functional components, i.e., the separate functions of consciousness, the complexes, hereditary units, etc. Disintegration, which may be functional or occasionally a real schizophrenia, is the fate which overtakes Gabricus in the Rosarium version. He is dissolved into atoms in the body of Bea. So long as consciousness refrains from acting, the opposites will remain dormant in the unconscious. Once they have been activated, the regius filius, spirit, logos, nous, is swallowed up by physis. In the hero myth, this state is known as being swallowed up in the belly of the whale or dragon. The heat there is usually so intense, a consequence of the war of affects, anxiety, anger, that the hero loses his hair and is reborn as bald as a babe. The philosopher makes the journey to hell as a redeemer. Jung continues the story. Earlier on, we left Eraclius and his companions, together with Bea and the dead Thebridius, in the triple glass house where they had been imprisoned by the Rex Marinus. They suffer from the intense heat, like the three whom Nebuchadnezzar cast into the fiery furnace. King Nebuchadnezzar had a vision of a fourth, like the Son of God, as we are told in Daniel 3:25. This vision is not without bearing on alchemy, since there are numerous passages in the literature stating that the stone is Trinus et Unus. It consists of the four elements, with fire representing the spirit concealed in matter. This is the fourth, absent and yet present, who always appears in the fiery agony of the furnace and symbolizes the divine presence, succor, and the completion of the work. And in their hour of need, Eraslaus and his companions see their master Pythagoras in a dream and beg him for help. He sends them his disciple Harpheretus, the author of Nourishment. So the work is completed and Thebridius comes to life again. We may suppose that Harpheretus brought them the miraculous food akin to the host, though this only becomes clear through a discovery of Ruscus, who gave us access to the text of the Codex Berolinensis. There, in an introduction that is missing from the printed versions of the Visio, we read, Pythagoras says, "Ye write and have written down for posterity how this most precious tree is planted, and how he that eats of its fruits shall hunger no more." The alchemical opus meant, at one level of analysis, the complete integration of unknown and known, insofar as that could be attained, but more profoundly, participation in the process that made one thing of unknown and known. This construct and act of construction typically had twin final aims, insofar as it constituted the pursuit of perfection. The first of these aims was union of the feminine material background of the unknown material world, seething with danger, passion, and sensuality, into harmony with the ordering principle of the spirit. This was represented symbolically as dissolution of the dead king and his subsequent regeneration after eating the miraculous food, which is the beneficial aspect of the unknown and the hero simultaneously. The second final aim was reintroduction of the integrated psychic structure to the physical body, the conscious incarnation of the now more complete spirit. So this meant that the union attained by the reincorporation of the material unknown was not complete if it was still a matter of philosophy or abstract conceptualization. The well-integrated spirit also had to be realized in behavior. And this was not necessarily yet even the final stage. The alchemist Dorn states, as cited by Jung, "We conclude that meditative philosophy consists in the overcoming of the body by mental union, unio mentalis. This first union does not as yet make the wise man, but only the mental disciple of wisdom. The second union of the mind with the body shows forth the wise man, hoping for and expecting that blessed third union with the first unity, the unus mundus, the latent unity of the world. May Almighty God grant that all men be made such, and may He be one in all." Dorn's ideas refer to a conjunction conceptualized as a three-stage process. The first stage was union of the mind, the overcoming the body by mental union. This stage refers to the integration of states of motivation, drives, emotions, into a single hierarchy dominated by the figure of the exploratory hero. The second stage was reunion of the united mind with the body. This is analogous to the second stage of the hero's journey. After the treasure is released, consequential to the battle with the dragon, the purely personal aspect of the hero's journey is completed. After all, he has found the treasure hard to attain. But the hero must return to the community. This is equivalent to Buddha's determination to retire from the state of nirvana until all who were living could make their home there. Is tantamount to the Buddha's belief that the redemption of the one was impossible in the presence of the unredeemed many. The reunion of the united mind with the body is inculcation of proper attitude in action, and is, therefore, the effect of the hero on the world. The third stage is particularly difficult to comprehend. Reconsideration of the theme of the tailor who mends, and who can therefore sew up the hole in the sky made by the dying king, might help with initial comprehension. Things that are wrong must be set right. This is a psychological process, even if undertaken purely as a consequence of actions conducted in the outside world. The union of the united spirit/body with the world means recognition of the essential equivalence of all experience, or consideration of all aspects of experience as literally equivalent to the self. We presume the existence of a final barrier between subject and object, but a standpoint exists that gives to all aspects of individual experience, whether subjective or objective, equal status as aspects of experience. Redeeming any aspect of that experience, then, whether material or psychological, whether self or other, is then regarded as the same act, as the act whose purpose is establishment of the kingdom of God, which is simultaneously psychological and social state. Spiritual work may therefore be regarded as indistinguishable from work on the external circumstances of existence. Redeem yourself, redeem the world. Or, alternatively, the attempt to bring about the perfection of the external world may be regarded as equivalent to the attempt to perfect oneself. After all, dedication to an ideal necessitates development of self-discipline. This is voluntary apprenticeship. The world and the self are not different places. From this perspective, all is experience. The attempt to redeem either necessarily brings about redemption in the other. All three of these conjunctions may be represented symbolically by the syzygy, the divine union of opposites, most generally considered as male and female. Number one, first, known, previous knowledge subsumed under patriarchal spiritual category, plus unknown, anomaly subsumed under matriarchal, affective, material, physical category, equals united spirit. Two, then united spirit, in this context, subsumed into the patriarchal spiritual category, plus body, subsumed under matriarchal material category, equals united spirit body. 3. Then united spirit body, in this context, subsumed under the patriarchal spiritual category, plus world, matriarchal material category, equals united spirit body world. All three of these unions can be considered variants of the incest motif, brother-sister, son-mother, king-queen pairings. Stage one, the mental union, was construed as necessary, valuable, but incomplete. The attainment of an ordered subjective state, stage two, was another important step along the way. Jung cites the alchemist Dorn, once again. Learn, therefore, O mind, to practice sympathetic love in regard to thine own body by restraining its vain appetites, that it may be apt with thee in all things. To this end I shall labor, that it may drink with thee from the fountain of strength, and, when the two are made one, that ye find peace in their union. Draw nigh, O body, to this fountain, that with thy mind thou mayest drink to satiety and hereafter thirst no more after vanities. O wondrous efficacy of this fount, which maketh one of two and peace between enemies! The fount of love can make mind out of spirit and soul, but this maketh one man out of mind and body. The third step, however, was critical. Philosophical knowledge and ordered intrapsychic structure, even when embodied, was regarded as insufficient. That embodied union must be extended to all the world, regarded as an aspect of experience, and therefore as equivalent, even identical, to the self. The alchemical procedure was based on the attempt to redeem matter, to transform it into an ideal. This procedure operated on the assumption that matter was originally corrupted, like man in the story of Genesis. The study of the transformations of corruption and limitation activated a mythological sequence in the mind of the alchemist. This sequence followed the pattern of the way upon which all religions have developed. Formal Christianity adopted the position that the sacrifice of Christ brought history to a close, and that belief in that sacrifice guaranteed redemption. Alchemy rejected that position in its pursuit of what remained unknown. In that heroic pursuit, the alchemist found himself transformed. As Jung states, "Whereas the Christian belief is that man is freed from sin by the redemptory act of Christ, the alchemist was evidently of the opinion that the restitution to the likeness of original and incorrupt nature had still to be accomplished by the art. And this can only mean that Christ's work of redemption was regarded as incomplete. In view of the wickedness which the prince of this world, undeterred, goes on perpetrating as liberally as before, one cannot withhold all sympathy from such an opinion. For an alchemist who professed allegiance to the Ecclesia Spiritualis, it was naturally of supreme importance to make himself an unspotted vessel of the Paraclete, and thus to realize the idea Christ on a plane far transcending a mere imitation of him." This realization of Christ on a plane transcending imitation is an overwhelming idea. It makes of religious belief something far more than belief, something far more terrifying and far more promising. The sequence of the alchemical transformation paralleled Christ's passion, paralleled the myth of the hero and his redemption. The essential message of alchemy is that individual rejection of tyranny, voluntary pursuit of the unknown and terrifying, predicated upon faith in the ideal, may engender an individual transformation so overwhelming that its equivalent can only be found in the most profound of religious myths. Jung cites German alchemist Heinrich Kuhnrath. "The son of the great world who is Theokosmos, i.e. a divine power and world, but whom even today, unfortunately, many who teach nature in a pagan spirit and many builders of medical science reject in the high university schools, is the exemplar of the stone which is Theanthropos, i.e. God and man, whom, as Scripture tells us, the builders of the church have also rejected. And from the same, in and from the great world book of nature, there issues a continuous and everlasting doctrine for the wise and their children. Indeed, it is a splendid living likeness of our Savior Jesus Christ, in and from the great world, which by nature is very similar to him, as to miraculous conception, birth, inexpressible powers, virtues, and effects. So God, our Lord, besides his Son's biblical histories, has also created a specific image and natural representation for us in the book of nature." It was in pursuit of the unknown that the alchemist experienced this psychological transformation, just as it was originally in contact with the unknown that the monotheistic patriarchal system developed in the furthest reaches of history. It is the symbolic expression of the action of instinct, which manifests itself in some variant of the hero myth whenever the unknown is pursued without avoidance in the attempt to improve life. The alchemist experienced what the individual always experiences when he determines to face every aspect of his existence, individual and collective, without denial or recourse to sterile preconceptions. As Jung comments, "The passion that vibrates in the alchemical text is genuine, but would be totally incomprehensible if the lapis were nothing but a chemical substance. Nor does it originate in contemplation of Christ's passion. It is the real experience of a man who has got involved in the compensatory contents of the unconscious by investigating the unknown seriously and to the point of self-sacrifice. He could not but see the likeness of his projected contents to the dogmatic images, which were in fact likely utilized by the instinctual procedure, and he might have been tempted to assume that his ideas were nothing else than the familiar religious conceptions which he was using in order to explain the chemical procedure. But the texts show clearly that, on the contrary, a real experience of the opus had an increasing tendency to assimilate the dogma or to amplify itself with it. In Christianity, spirit descends to matter, and the result of the union is the birth of Christ and, unfortunately, the formal realization of his opponent. In alchemy, which compensated for the one-sided view of Christianity, matter rises to spirit with analogous result, creation of the lapis or philosophical stone, which bears an unmistakable resemblance to Christ embodied in abstractly material form. This form, the philosopher's stone, the lapis, was composed of the most paradoxical elements. It was base, cheap, immature, and volatile. Perfect, precious, ancient, and solid. Visible to all, yet mysterious. Costly, dark, hidden, and evident, having one name and many names. The lapis was also the renewed king, the wise old man, and the child. The wise old man possesses the charisma of wisdom, which is the knowledge that transcends the limits of history. The child represents the creative spirit, the possibility in man, the Holy Ghost. He is not the child of ignorance, but the innocence of maturity. He precedes and antedates history in the subjective and collective sense. As Jung comments, "The child is all that is abandoned and exposed, and at the same time divinely powerful, the insignificant, dubious beginning and the triumphal end. The eternal child in man is an indescribable experience, an incongruity, a handicap, and a divine prerogative, an imponderable that determines the ultimate worth or worthlessness of a personality." This final value, the goal of the pursuit of the alchemists, is discovery and embodiment of the meaning of life itself. Integrated, subjective being actively expressing its nature through manipulation of the possibilities inherent in the material/unknown world. This final goal is the production of an integrated intrapsychic condition, identical to that of the mythological hero, acted out in a world regarded as equivalent to the self. Production of this condition, the lapis philosophorum, constitutes the antidote for the corruption of the world attendant upon the fall, attendant upon the emergence of partial self-consciousness. The lapis is agent of transformation, equivalent to the mythological redemptive hero, able to turn base metals into gold. It is, as such, something more valuable than gold, just as the hero is more valuable than any of his concrete productions. The complete alchemical opus, with production of the lapis as goal, is presented schematically in Figure 66, the alchemical opus as myth of redemption. Alchemy was a living myth, the myth of the individual man as redeemer. Organized Christianity had sterilized itself, so to speak, by insisting on the worship of some external truth as the means to salvation. The alchemists rediscovered the error of this presumption and came to realize that identification with the Redeemer was in fact necessary, not his worship. That myths of redemption had true power when they were incorporated and acted out, rather than believed in some abstract sense. This meant to say that Christ was the greatest man in history, a combination of the divine and mortal, was not sufficient expression of faith. Sufficient expression meant the attempt to live out the myth of the hero within the confines of individual personality, to voluntarily shoulder the cross of existence, to unite the opposites within a single breast, and to serve as active, conscious mediator between the eternal generative forces of known and unknown.